Call the Civil Law Committee to order. Clerk will note quorum is present. Is there a motion to approve the 3:16:11 minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the approval of the 3:16:11 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, a little housekeeping, and for people in the audience, the House File 1130 dealt with a data practices matter relating to some higher education institutions. We will be referring that to the subcommittee on data practices. Potentially, they will be meeting in the near future on that bill, or not. Just stay tuned for further updates. But that bill won't be heard in this committee as of today until the subcommittee's had a chance to hear it and work on it if there's any changes. And so if there's anybody here for that, I want to give you that information. House File 936 is up in front of our committee today, members. Excuse me. The bill actually didn't get referred Thursday to our committee, but we had a plan to hear it, and so we will take testimony, pro and con, and introduce the bill to our committee. However, we will not move it until after session today. That's you saw in the notice we will be coming back potentially briefly after session. Here's what I propose as the chair, and for a format to work through this bill. I've told the author will give the proponents a half hour to present their case and information on the bill. We will open it up for some questions then, and we'll give the opposition a half hour to present their matters to the committee, and we will open it up after that again for further questions. After session, members, we will allow committee discussion, but the testifiers, unless there's a specific, unless there's something we can't get an answer from the author on, the plan would be we will have committee discussion and a vote after session, whatever doesn't get hashed out before we adjourn today or recess at 2:15. And so, but we will work through the testifiers. A half hour on each side. Representative Holberg's side will start, the author of the bill, and they will. We will move the bill officially once we've got the bill in front of us. Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you anticipate that we will be limiting the testimony to the issues that are within the Civil Law Committee, or will we be rehashing the Health Committee testimony, or what do you envision for the testimony today, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom, I envision we should limit the testimony as much as possible to the matters relating to the Civil Law Committee. I would ask the testifiers to try to limit their testimony to those key provisions, although, as you know, Representative Hillstrom, other matters kind of come in the gray area or come in committees often, and so that's the chair's intention with the idea that it's sometimes hard to tell where one line starts and the other stops. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, do you want to proceed with your bill? We will again we will go through up to a half hour. If you don't have a half hour, that's fine, but I would ask members to write their questions down, and we will ask questions after you and the presenters are completed. And we'll give you a five-minute warning and a one-minute warning if you get to that point of your 30 minutes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And the committee should have the first engrossment of this bill in front of you. This was exactly as it left the Health Reform Committee and reflects a delete all amendment that was adopted in the Health Reform Committee. And as far as I can tell, the parts of the bill that would be of most interest to this committee would be sections 2, on sections 8 through 11. And I think what I'm going to do today is I'm going to let the testifiers that are here for the bill, in support of the bill, provide their testimony first. I'll fill in any holes, and then we'd be happy to stand for questions. I have Ms. Rao from Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life and Professor Teresa Collette prepared to testify.
Very good. Ms. Rao, you do you want us to begin? Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization of more than 70,000 member families in more than 240 chapters across the state of Minnesota. We are dedicated to the single issue of protecting innocent human life. It is my privilege to discuss this new legislation, the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. I would like to take a minute just to provide background to the committee so that you do have an understanding when we talk about the penalties and those kinds of things of what this legislation is and why we are bringing it forward. I would like to draw your attention to the findings section of the bill, which I know is somewhat unusual for here in Minnesota to have a findings section, but really without that section, this bill makes little sense. The findings outline a number of key facts related to the ability of the unborn child to feel pain, and these findings have been backed up with abundant written documentation that was submitted previously. Most with expertise in the area of fetal pain, including fetal surgeons, agree with the consensus that the unborn child is capable of feeling pain by at least 20 weeks after conception. Pain and the empathy that we all feel towards those experiencing pain is an innately human experience. Every parent whose child is hurt and every child whose parent is suffering pain due to illness or disease strives to ease that pain. We have many laws, customs, and traditions that seek to protect others from pain. Should we not extend this to the most vulnerable child, the unborn child? The loss of a loved one, especially a child, is always tragic, and I have great sympathy for any family that suffers such a devastating loss. Years ago, when prenatal screening was much less sophisticated, and more children were born with disabilities and anomalies incompatible with life, it was not uncommon for these newborns to be untreated and left to die. That became illegal in Minnesota decades ago, as the citizens of our state decided that those children were deserving of the respect and dignity that we offer to other struggling members of our human family. Similarly, this legislation is not about whether or not women have a right to abortion, even in relation to an adverse diagnosis of their unborn child. In fact, nearly all of the abortions in Minnesota that are done because of a fetal anomaly are done earlier in pregnancy. Rather, this legislation is about whether or not an unborn child who is developed to the point that he or she is capable of feeling pain is deserving of the respect and dignity that we offer to other members of our human family. The supporters of this legislation believe that indeed such unborn children are worthy of such dignity. Consider that nationwide, the most common abortion procedure at this stage of development is a D&E, or in layman's terms, a dismemberment abortion. That means the doctor reaches in with a forceps, grabs a limb, and rips it off. He removes it, then goes back for the next one, until he has removed every piece of the unborn child. If the unborn child feels pain, as experts believe, imagine what that child must endure. Unborn children at 20 weeks after conception have the physiological systems in place to perceive pain. They also move away from painful stimuli, and they have increased levels of stress hormones coinciding with when one would expect them to feel pain. These stress hormones are lowered when the unborn child is provided pain-reducing medication. Today, fetal surgery is a growing medical specialty, as conditions like spina bifida can sometimes be treated before a child is even born. Prior to these surgeries, unborn children are now routinely provided pain medication. While most children at 20 weeks after conception are not able to survive on their own, viability is generally only 1 to 3 weeks at the most later. And according to the Department of Health's report, we are performing abortions on viable babies in Minnesota. I would ask you to take a look at this diaper in my hand. This is a size 1 diaper. This is the size of diaper that my children worn right when they were born. I'll admit there's one size smaller called a newborn, but my kids were all too big for the newborn size. This is a preemie diaper. This is a diaper that is worn by these children right at the point of viability and just after. These children are at the same stage of development as many of the unborn children that this bill is seeking to protect. These are the lives that we're talking about, and the lives that we believe deserve the respect and dignity that we give to other members of our human family. A pain-capable unborn child, viable or not, is a member of our human family, and we believe is sufficiently developed to be recognized as such and protected by law. We believe that the state has a compelling interest in protecting the life of an unborn child capable of feeling pain, and I urge each of you to support the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak here today.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Ms. Collette, if you can introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to our committee. You may proceed. Remember, members, mark your questions down. We'll ask after the testifiers are done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Teresa Collette, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this committee as well as to submit my written testimony, which elaborates on it. I will spare this committee a reading of the 11 pages of written testimony that I have provided to the committee. However, because there are non-lawyer members of the committee, with the chairman's indulgence, I will give a very brief history of abortion regulation under the federal Constitution. My testimony today is limited to the constitutionality of this proposed act. I do not intend to address the medical aspects, although I covered that in my law review article, one of the first law review articles dealing with fetal pain. While I am a professor at the University of St. Thomas in the law school, I am a tenured full professor and teach constitutional law as well as bioethics. I also serve as the special attorney general for the state of Oklahoma in defending that state's ultrasound laws, and have served as special attorney general for the state of Kansas defending the sex abuse reporting law. Therefore, I'm speaking both as a academic and a practicing lawyer with expertise in the regulation of abortion. I am not, however, speaking on behalf of the University of St. Thomas or any other organization or individual. Abortion regulation in the United States began, the constitutional implications began in 1973 with Roe versus Wade. In that opinion, the United States Supreme Court struck down the laws of all 50 states regarding the regulation of abortion. And since that point, it has been a political and divisive legal issue for the past 38 years. In 1976, the court used what it had developed in Roe versus Wade, a rigid trimester system, in order to strike down reasonable regulations of abortion, including informed consent requirements and reporting requirements that protect the health of women by requiring reporting of basic information to various state departments of health. The court continued this extremely rigid position. And that phrase was used by a majority of the court in the Webster opinion in characterizing the trimester system, its extremely rigid approach to abortion regulation in Kaladi in 1979, and in Thornburg in 1986, when it struck down a requirement that a second physician be present during the abortion of a viable child in order to preserve the life of that child if possible. It was not until 1989 with the Webster opinion, Webster versus Reproductive Services, where the United States Supreme Court clearly rejected the idea that the state had no interest in the unborn child or fetal life from the moment of conception forward. In 1989, in a plurality opinion joined by Justice Kennedy, the court was very clear that the state's interest in the protection of fetal life begins from the moment of conception and simply increases from that point all the way through the pregnancy. In 1992, a second plurality opinion, again joined by Justice Kennedy, the court held that the rigid trimester system that it adhered to and had applied with such a vengeance through 1989 was no longer the law of the land. Rather, they adopted what is called an undue burden test, in which they recognized that while a woman has a limited liberty interest under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution, that liberty interest does not trump the state's interest in protecting fetal life unless the law creates what the court called an undue burden upon that woman's right. Casey marked a turning point in abortion jurisprudence. It recognized the intense and indeed even compelling interest the state has in protecting the unborn child. In the first opinion related to a partial birth abortion, in Carhart versus Stenberg, a bitterly divided court struck down Nebraska's partial birth abortion bill on the basis that it did not contain a health exception. The Nebraska court had not adequately developed its legislative record. The U.S. Constitution, learning from the opinion, came and held hearings. The hearings resulted in a strong evidentiary record indicating that partial birth abortion, or what the court calls on occasion intact DNE, or what some medical providers call DNX abortion, was not medically necessary. There was dispute over that medical fact, but the court, in a majority opinion authored by Justice Kennedy, found that the legislative fact-finding was sufficient to support the federal partial birth abortion ban, which applied both pre-viability and post-viability and had no health of the mother exception. It is these final three cases that suggest that this bill may indeed be constitutional. Let me be quite clear. Prior to this, the court has articulated viability as the point at which a state can, in fact, prohibit almost all abortions except those necessary, in the words of the court, to preserve the life or the health of the mother. The health of the mother exception has been redefined from its original definition in 1973 in Doe versus Bolton to the definition that was in the Pennsylvania legislation before the court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and it is that definition that you will find in Section 4, Subsection 5 of the bill before you. In that instance, the question then is not, does this bill meet the viability standards? I will tell you quite candidly, it does not adopt the viability standard for its prohibition. Rather, this bill is directed at determining whether or not fetal pain that has been established to exist at 20 post-fertilization weeks and further is a sufficient state interest to allow a state to ban all non-therapeutic abortions. Note that, in fact, there are more abortions permitted under this bill than were permitted to be conducted through the use of DNX under Carhart II, because this bill does contain a health exception, unlike the law before the court in Carhart II. This bill is intended to provide the courts the opportunity to articulate a second important state interest that will indeed allow a state government to prohibit abortions if it has an adequate health and life of the mother exception. It will be a question of first impression if it is presented to the court. Let me anticipate a question that I suspect I will be asked had I not addressed it otherwise. Do I believe this bill will in fact be challenged in the courts? Had you asked me a year ago when I was testifying in front of the Nebraska state legislature, I would have said, of course. Dr. Leroy Carhart has proved himself to be litigious, not once but twice, going all the way to the United States Supreme Court. However, interestingly enough, this bill, modeled after the Nebraska legislation, has been in effect in the state of Nebraska for well over a year, and yet no litigation has been filed. In fact, Dr. Leroy Carhart has ceased doing abortions that would violate this provision in the state of Nebraska, instead choosing to transplant his late-term abortion practice to the state of Maryland, where no such regulation exists. That suggests that, in fact, a challenge is less likely than one would have anticipated, particularly when you look at the number of abortions that would be impacted by this law in the state of Minnesota. For that number, I direct you to Appendix A, attached to my written testimony, where you see that in the state of Minnesota, the number of reported abortions ranges from a low of 5 in 2004 to a high of 19 in 2006, which were performed at or after 22 weeks of gestation. Let me make a final point about the definitions. The Minnesota reporting statute currently uses gestational age. The bill before you adopts post-fertilization age. As noted in the footnote to the appendix, House File 936 calculates the age of the pregnancy based on the estimated date of fertilization rather than gestation. Gestational age is always 22 weeks more than fertilization age, because gestational age is calculated from the woman's last menstrual period, and fertilization is estimated 2 weeks after that period. Thus, a fetus that is 22 weeks gestational age is 20 weeks post-fertilization age. That's an important point, because the Supreme Court has recognized that viability may begin as early as 23 gestational weeks or 21 post-fertilization weeks. While we're talking about only a small number of unborn children that would be protected by this bill, every life that is protected from what one expert has called excruciating pain is important. And I would be deeply saddened if, in fact, we had 5 to 19 cases of individuals who had experienced torturous conduct and this legislature didn't feel moved to act in other settings. I hope they will be moved to act in this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Collette. And we will open it up for questions and then ask the opposition to offer their testimony, and we'll open it up for questions for them. Members, any questions? Representative Hillstrom, first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The previous testifier testified that it is unusual to have findings in a statute such as this, and cited that she had previously submitted the research which showed why these particular findings were the right ones. Mr. Chair, I have not seen any previously submitted testimony, and it's difficult to ask questions about findings and whether the findings in the statute match the findings in the report if I haven't seen the previously submitted materials. Mr. Chair, can you tell me, will those materials be forthcoming, and will I have the opportunity to ask questions once I've received them?
Representative Hillstrom, I understand we're getting a copy of that report as we sit here, and so it should be coming very soon.
Mr. Chair, the second portion of the question, once I've seen them and have had the opportunity to look at them, will I have the opportunity to ask questions about the findings in the bill, Mr. Chair?
Assuming it shows up fairly soon, Representative Hillstrom, you should. You will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Collette. I appreciated the rendition on the court history of this right. But what I recall is you citing at you got the end of it, suggesting that it may very well be that this could be found constitutional. Based on that expectation, or maybe hope is a better word, what do you expect would be the total cost of all the litigation that would have to go in this special fund? Because I'm looking for the information about what it would cost to carry on litigation, which currently protects the constitutional right, and apparently this doctor, who you called litigious, is rather persistent. So how much is it going to cost us, is my question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hope.
If I might, we are waiting for a fiscal note on this, and if the bill does reflect a fiscal note, it will be heard in Chair Lanning's committee.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't think that Professor Collette's an expert in cost of litigation, and while it's certainly probably of interest to the Civil Law Committee, it's probably of more interest to the Finance Committee.
Well, and Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. And Representative Holberg, I understand that and appreciate that. I have no idea how you'd come up with a fiscal note, even among the experts, because I just don't think there's any way to know. But the reason I ask is not to drive us down a question about the actual fiscal note implications, as much as it is a question about there's no absolutely while this thing were to be litigated over the course of 2, 5, 10 years, it would be coming up in here again guaranteed over the course of that time, because when people are having a problem in the courts, they bring it to the legislature and vice versa. So I was more asking that in order to determine how long we'd have to be struggling with this issue if the bill were to pass. So I understand and appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Professor Collette, I just want to make sure I understand part of your testimony. I thought I heard you say that after one or both of the Carhart decisions in Nebraska, that it was the legislature that engaged in some extensive evidentiary hearings. Is that right? Was it the legislature or was it someone else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, Congress engaged in extensive legislative hearings, which resulted in the federal partial birth abortion ban, which was upheld in Gonzales versus Carhart in 2007 by a majority opinion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Simon.
And Professor Collette, could you describe for us the nature, the scope, the extent of the evidentiary hearings? Was it one hearing of an hour and a half or 2 hours? Was it multiple hearings? How many testifiers? Can you tell us a little bit about what happened at those evidentiary hearings? How extensive were they in scope and duration?
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to submit, in fact, the legislative record from the congressional hearings if the chairman would allow me to. There were multiple hearings, although I believe that much of it was submitted evidentiarily, was submitted through documents and peer-reviewed medical journal articles.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I appreciate that. I would imagine that they were a lot more extensive than we've had here at the Minnesota legislature. And I guess I would just reiterate what Representative Hillstrom was getting at or seemed to be getting at, which is these findings in the bill certainly don't represent any findings that I have any competence in, because I haven't been exposed to the underlying assertions or the data or anything like that. So I hope that I just want to say for the record, they don't represent any finding that I would make. And I doubt that they would represent a finding that someone on the previous committee would make, because my understanding that there was sort of cursory testimony there. So I hope that the record's clear there. But I want to ask Professor Collette, too, this distinction between gestational age and post-fertilization age. Is gestational age another way of saying that that life begins at conception, or is there a distinction there?
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, I am a little at sea at exactly the question. The language speaks for itself. Post-fertilization is a medical term used in medical texts on a regular basis, particularly with the creation of embryonic life that is not sustained in the uterus, for example. You have to have a way to date the age of the embryo. So post-fertilization is a well-accepted medical term.
Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if you could describe or re-describe, in case I didn't absorb it the first time, what you mean by gestational age, which I understand to be the measuring point here in this bill. How would you describe it in layperson's terms? Or am I misstating the...
Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon, if I might, at the bottom of Appendix A, the gestational age is the date from a woman's last period. So that's 2 weeks longer in general terms than the date of fertilization. It's just another terminology used. And you can see that explained on the bottom of Appendix A, which is attached to Professor Collette's testimony.
Mr. Chair, do we have Professor Collette's testimony?
No.
Well, I must have it somewhere. I'll take a look at that. Thanks.
Representative Holberg, a question for you. The funds, I read that the county attorney may bring action or the county attorney general. Would the county attorney be able to access the funds set up in this account if they have actions, or who would be reimbursed by this account for defending this law?
Mr. Chair and committee, on page one of the bill under section two, the fund is for the purpose of providing funds to pay for any costs and expenses incurred by the state attorney general in relation to actions surrounding the defense of the sections in the bill.
Any other questions, members? Otherwise, we'll go to the... Oh, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr.
Then
Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I have two questions. One is in the definitions section on page 3 at lines 22 through 25. Why does the definition of abortion include the removal of a dead child who died of natural causes or accident or criminal assault?
Representative Holberg or one of the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in fact, it says other than the removal of a dead child. It is to exempt that circumstance. If you look at line 3.21, known to be pregnant with the intention other than to increase the probability of a live birth, to preserve the life or health of the child after live birth, or to remove. So it is an exception to the definition of abortion.
Okay, thank you. Then the next question I have is with regard to the legislative findings. What is the data that purportedly backs up the legislative findings?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
If I might, I know the pages are making copies of about a 14-page document that cites all kinds of studies, and so that should be before the committee here momentarily. So it's quite extensive background.
Mr. Chair, then I would expect that we'll have a quite extensive discussion of those 14 pages, because what I'm hearing the witness testify to is the critical part about this bill from a standpoint of constitutionality is legislative findings. And in the absence of these legislative findings, that they would have more difficulty in defending the constitutionality of the bill. And I'm also very interested as a legislator, anytime it says the legislature makes the following findings, that we, in fact, are making those findings. And this seems to be a lot of purportedly scientific conclusions, and we don't have any evidence in front of us at all that backs up any one of those statements. So I wouldn't think that it would be appropriate for the legislature to pass the bill without having enough information to make those types of findings.
Representative Horton, we'll each get to make our own judgment call on those findings, and that'll ultimately be borne out by a majority and a minority vote. So whichever side has the majority of votes will probably substantiate the findings, and if the findings don't have a majority vote, they won't be substantiated. That's pretty much the process of the legislature, as you well know. But Representative Mahoney.
Interesting statement, Mr. Chair. I earlier I burst out laughing, and I want to apologize. I was, and again, that's inappropriate, and I shouldn't do that in committee. But what I would really like to know is, and I'd like to build off of Representative Hillstrom's question about what apparently is a 14-page listing of studies that is being done, copied by the pages and being handed out, and how much time we're going to have to take a look at those particular studies, if we're just going to have this committee hearing time to look at those studies. It's really not, it's kind of limiting how much deliberation we can give to those particular studies, how much thought, how much viewing of the studies, because frankly, if there's variety of studies in there, I'm going to guess that they're all more than a couple pages long. You could easily have 30 pages or 300 pages, and in 15 minutes, I don't think you can really give a 15-page study or a 300-page study much deliberate viewing of it to see if what we're going to vote on of legislative findings is a good idea. So, Mr. Chair, to further Representative Hillstrom's question, how much time after we get this list of studies are we going to have to take a look at them before we get to ask questions about these particular studies? I'd like to know who did the study, who paid for the study, you know, when was it done, were there any refuting studies that came just from the other tack? Simple questions, Mr. Chair, but they do have great bearing on how we pass a bill or a law around here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hulbert.
If I might, we'll get you the information momentarily. And certainly there was discussion around this issue in the Health Committee. But if I might just to illustrate, the history of this whole issue, going way back to 1984, President Reagan in a speech talked about, this was his quote, he said, "There's a grim truth we should face up to. Medical science doctors confirm that when the lives of the unborn are snuffed out, they often feel pain, pain that is long and agonizing." Following those remarks, a letter was submitted by 26 leading physicians across the country, and in fact, they quoted the words of an abortionist in this letter. And it said, indeed, one doctor, the New York Times wrote, conscientiously performs saline abortions. His quote, "When you inject the saline, you often see an increase in fetal movements. It's horrible." So decades ago, doctors were beginning to discover the reactions of babies at this age to different stimuli, in this case, salt or saline, burning the babies to death, a type of abortion that can take up to 24 hours. Since that time, we have had the growth of neonatology. There has been increasing numbers of surgery done on babies in the womb in which they've been able to document the actual reaction of the baby to sharp objects. They've been able to quantify the increase of hormone related, similar to hormones in adults, that are related to a pain reaction in adults. I think you will find the information quite compelling about the ability of the baby to feel pain. In addition, Minnesota was the first state in the country to include information about fetal pain in its Women's Right to Know legislation a number of years ago. That information has not been challenged in the courts of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Two things here. I don't think I need a lecture on technology or medical technology, Representative Hulbert. Now, all I asked for was the studies and how long we were going to have to take a look at them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if the Representative Mahoney felt like I was providing a lecture. That was not my intent. I was trying to provide some context and an overview of the type of information presented in these studies that you will soon be able to review.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hulbert, all I was asking of the chair was to how long we were going to have to take a look at those particular studies.
Representative Mahoney, you're going to have till after session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch, and then we'll allow the other testifiers that have asked to testify against this bill come to the table. So Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I wanted to address a statement that you made in response to, I think it was Representative Hortman's comments that about the findings of fact in here, that we would decide what the truth is based on a majority vote of this committee, reminded me of one of my favorite bands, the local Soul Asylum, not too far from Representative Hoppe's district, I think, is where they started playing. They had a song, the lyrics that went, try to do the right thing, play it straight, but the right thing changes from state to state. Mr. Chair, I don't think we want to denigrate the truth or what is true with respect to facts in a bill based on who happens to have the majority at any given time on this committee or who happens to have the majority in the House of Representatives at any given time. That's why I think entering these specific findings of truth or what's true, what's not in this bill is anathema to lawmaking. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, I understand the testimony of the author is that if we don't have it in there, the bill doesn't make sense. That's what was specifically said. I think that probably speaks for itself. I just wanted to state those objections on the record, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch, you know the process as well. We'll entertain a motion to remove them if you want later. That'll be part of the committee discussion. But Representative Lesch, before you go down the road too far of that, I would just urge you to go back and look at something that has been become proven more of a farce every year, and that's global warming and what happened in this legislature 3-4 years ago and some of the findings that haven't bore out. So I don't think you can stand too meritorious on that issue, but it does happen from time to time, and I'm not proposing that it happens by who's in control. It's still an unforeseen conclusion of what would happen with this bill in this committee or in the House of Representatives. Representative Lesch, we've got a lot of new freshmen. This legislative body, people change their positions over time. And so I don't think it's a foregone conclusion how any bill, quite frankly, will end up this session, because it's a new legislative day with over 35 new members in the House, and that's as unpredictable as the weather. So Representative Holberg, you wanted
to
comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesch, I can't let you put words in my mouth. I did not make a statement about the findings. Maybe you're confusing that with one of my testifiers. But, members, I think that you should know that this legislation, while has passed in Nebraska, is also be considered in about 10 other states. And unlike other abortion legislation, in this case, we are seeing even those that would identify themselves as pro-choice actually supporting this language, this bill, recognizing the humanity of the baby at this stage. And in fact, Oklahoma, it passed their House on a vote of 94-2. Kansas, on the 24th of February, passed their legislature 91-30. And so historically, how it's passed the unicameral legislature in Nebraska and the House in both Kansas and Oklahoma, the totality of that is an 86% support for this legislation. So I don't think that we should make assumptions about minorities and majorities. This is an important piece of legislation that I hope that everybody will consider based on its merits.
Representative Hillstrom, to this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, can you tell me, the legislation says that the legislature makes the following findings. Other than the committee hearing that you had in health and this committee hearing, has this legislature looked at these studies and actually pulled these out? Was there a working group? Was there a legislative body? How is it that the legislature made these following findings?
Representative Holver.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, this bill has just been heard in health reform, and now it's here today. But that's not unlike other bills that have findings in them over the years. In this case, there wasn't a working group, but that's not unusual.
Representative Holberg, thank you to your witnesses. They'll stick around. We might have further questions, but I'd like to have Ms. Jackson come up, who's asked to testify in opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Jackson, welcome to our committee. If you want to come forward, we are only aware of you testifying in opposition, so you've got a half hour to use. If you know of others that are similarly situated and want to testify, I would ask you to divide your time up with them as well. And so is there anybody else that wants to testify in opposition to this today? Please let us know so we can ration the 30 minutes both sides have had appropriately and fairly. Send a message up through a page to us up here if you planned to testify in opposition. Ms. Jackson, welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm a lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are the Minnesota affiliate of the ACLU. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. To the best of my knowledge, I think I'm the only one testifying. This is a legal committee, and I'm here to testify about the law. I do want to clarify one point of fact. The question was raised about the informed consent language on fetal pain. On the Minnesota website, which I don't think has changed since the governor has changed, it says that fetal pain, there's no consensus on the issue of fetal pain. So as far as informed consent goes, that's the official language. But I'm here to testify about the constitutionality of House File 936. We oppose it because it is unconstitutional and an unnecessary intrusion into the private medical decisions of women in Minnesota. Healthcare decisions are deeply personal and very fact-specific. It is impossible for a legislative committee to hear and understand the complexity of any individual's healthcare decision. That is why the Supreme Court has drawn the line on whether abortion is legal at viability, not on a specific date of pregnancy. From Roe v. Wade in 1973 to Gonzalez v. Carhart in 2007, the Supreme Court has specifically declined to let legislation replace the discretion of a woman and her doctor. Because House File 936 sets inflexible guidelines instead of case-specific facts surrounding an individual's health, House File 936 will be found unconstitutional. For more than 35 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that the constitutional rights of liberty and privacy extend to the decision of a woman to terminate her pregnancy. The court first reached this conclusion in the landmark decision of Roe v. Wade, where the court specifically held that, one, a state may not ban abortion prior to fetal viability, and two, a state may ban abortion after viability so long as there are exceptions to protect the woman's health and life. The court explained in Roe that viability was that point in pregnancy when the fetus is potentially able to live outside the mother's womb, albeit with artificial aid. In Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, the Supreme Court reaffirmed these central tenets of Roe. The plurality opinion specifically held that viability marks the earliest point at which the state's interest in fetal life is constitutionally adequate to justify a legislative ban on non-therapeutic abortions. The Minnesota Supreme Court read the Minnesota Constitution's right to privacy even more broadly than the United States Constitution. In Doe v. Gomez, a 1995 decision, it specifically struck down the legislation because it interferes with a woman's decision-making process. Central to each decision upholding the right to an abortion is holding that viability is a medical decision and cannot be legislated as a fixed number of weeks. Furthermore, House File 936 threatens women's health and therefore will be found unconstitutional. House File 936 states that abortion after 20 weeks is banned unless the woman has a condition which so complicates her medical condition as to necessitate the abortion of her pregnancy to avert her death or to avert serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function. The Supreme Court has held that the term a woman's health is a much broader concept than this definition. The 2007 Carhart decision by the Supreme Court upheld the specifically named abortion procedure only because it did not restrict other options to protect a woman's health. By placing such a restrictive definition of a woman's health, House File 936 will not survive constitutional scrutiny. Therefore, because House File 936 will not survive constitutional scrutiny, and because it substitutes the judgment of the legislature for a patient and her doctor regarding her health, we urge you to vote no on House File 936. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Questions, members? Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Jackson, how does this bill on the points of contention you brought up as far as unconstitutionality differ from the Nebraska bill? The testimony before you said it was similar, if not almost identical, and it hasn't been challenged for over a year. So if your testimony would be correct, why hasn't the Nebraska law been challenged? I know I put a couple questions in there for you, but go ahead and respond.
Ms. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, I'm not familiar with Nebraska. I work here in Minnesota. I don't know why it has not been challenged, but the Minnesota Constitution is not the Nebraska Constitution, and regardless of the federal constitutionality of it, it would not withstand scrutiny under the Minnesota Constitution.
Representative Grunhagen, any follow-up?
It just seems to me that the previous testifier had a lot more documentation and understanding of the legal ramifications of the law nationally and in other states than what this current testifier does. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Jackson, to that last point you made, can you reiterate, or what is it specifically under the Minnesota Constitution you think is not going to meet the challenge, regardless of the federal Constitution?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, just because the law has not been challenged in Nebraska doesn't mean that it won't be or that it couldn't be. Okay, that means that there's not a specific plaintiff right now who wants to challenge it. And I can't speak to the people of Nebraska. I'm a Minnesotan. I work here in Minnesota.
Correct.
Okay, so I can't say why someone hasn't come forward on that. It has nothing to do with the state of the law. It has to do more with the people who are in Nebraska. As far as the Minnesota law goes, or the Minnesota Constitution, the decision Doe v. Gomez specifically held that the Minnesota Constitution has a greater right to privacy than the federal Constitution. And I didn't bring it with me. I almost did, so I could read you word for word what it says. But that's a specific holding. It's well established in Minnesota that the Minnesota right to an abortion through the right of privacy is greater than that of the federal Constitution. And that's established law.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Jackson, it sounds like, from what I gathered from your testimony, you are saying that there is conflict or a difference between Doe versus Gomez and the prevailing Supreme Court decisions. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way the two constitutions work together is that the federal constitution provides a baseline of protection of individual rights. It is possible for a state constitution to provide greater personal protections than the federal constitution does. So in this case, the Minnesota Supreme Court read a 1995 decision. So they looked at the federal holdings on the woman's right to an abortion and said, we in Minnesota are going to give a greater protection to individual women. We are not going to allow laws to be passed and held constitutional which interfere with a woman's decision-making process. And this bill, by making so many decisions legislatively, would violate that principle. So they're not in conflict. The Minnesota Constitution goes above the protection of the federal Constitution. So if it were taken to the Supreme Court saying, oh, look, the Minnesota Supreme Court is in conflict with this, they wouldn't find that. They'd say it's within the purview of the state to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Jackson, in that same line of thinking then, would it be consistent to say that the federal decisions that have come down offer greater personal protections to the baby than the Minnesota decision does?
Ms. Jackson?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that there is greater protection of the individual woman. I don't think that any decision has looked at it from that point of view, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Ms. Jackson, on that same vein, you're telling us that Minnesota's Constitution doesn't have as much protection for the infant baby as the federal constitution has allowed, but our constitution, state constitution, in your opinion, is going to strike this law down as unconstitutional in favor of the right of the mother, not in favor of the right of the child. Is that a fair recap?
No, it's not. I object to you, Mr. Chairman. I object to the use of your term infant and baby and child. We're talking about a fetus. They are differentiated. That's the whole point of viability. When a baby is viable, it can live outside the womb, albeit with artificial help. Before that point, it is not, under the state of the law, considered to be a child or an infant.
So Ms. Jackson, maybe you can answer this so we know where you're coming from. Is the fetus living or not living, in your opinion?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
just yes or no answer.
I'm not going to opine on that because I'm just a lobbyist, and my opinion doesn't matter. It matters whether what the Supreme Court would say, and I would say that if you want to take that to the Supreme Court, you can ask them that question, but I am not qualified to answer that.
Does the ACLU have a position on that? Because I understand that's who you're representing here, testifying to us against this bill.
Mr. Chairman, the ACLU believes that life begins at birth. I believe that's the statement. And quite frankly, I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you,
Representative
Mr.
Simon.
Ms. Jackson, you said Doe versus Gomez was decided in 1995?
That's correct.
Okay, that was 15 years ago. And I think, you know, the court decision probably made that decision based on medical facts and other things at that particular time. There's been a number of decisions legally, and the medical advancement in terms of understanding the viability of the baby, I hope that doesn't offend you, has gone up dramatically. In fact, we now know medically and scientifically that life does begin at conception, okay? And so there's been a huge advancement in science and medicine the last 15 years. So I think that would have a bearing on the court, and especially the Supreme Court decisions that have followed since 1995. Any response to those comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Jackson.
The decision in Doe v. Gomez, Representative Grunhagen, I would recommend that you read it. It talks about the decision-making process of the woman. It does not go into any medical details whatsoever. It's whether the state is going to interfere in the decision-making process of the woman. It's nothing to do. It does not touch on science whatsoever. It's about the law and who makes the decision. And in that case, they said that the law cannot interfere with the woman's decision-making process.
Ms. Jackson, to assist Mr. Grunhagen, and you can confirm or expand on this, that decision is also the one that's required the state under medical assistance or public assistance to fund abortions. Is that not the impetus of that decision as well?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative Grunhagen, are you done? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, actually, if I could, for the author or maybe for Professor Collette, if we're
done with any, can I just go through any further questions for Ms. Jackson, Representative Simon?
No, not for me.
Okay. Any further questions, members, for Ms. Jackson? Otherwise, we'll ask Ms. Collette to come back. Representative Grunhagen, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just one addition. You know, just a personal comment is that, you know, I actually, when I was younger, I didn't have much of an opinion as far as abortion is concerned, and I kind of bought into the idea that it wasn't real life. But then one day, I started doing more studying on it, just as a lay person, and one of the things I read that helped convince me, not only the medical and scientific facts, but if you take the word fetus and insert the word slave in it instead, and use your rationale, you begin to see that your rationale falls apart when you're talking about another human being. So I just give that for a suggestion for you to think about.
Any further questions, members, for Ms. Jackson? Representative Juskowski.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Jackson, thank you for your testimony, and we'll ask Ms. Collette to come back to the table.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I might, I believe
Representative Berg.
Professor Collette would like to us respond a little bit about the questions regarding the Nebraska law.
And I'll let Representative Simon ask her his question, and then that might be a segue or not. I don't know. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is either for the author or for Professor Collette. Since this is a civil law committee, I thought we'd talk about the civil remedy that this creates, which is on line 7.3 of the bill. It's Section 8, Subdivision 2. And there's a paragraph A and paragraph B. Paragraph B, I can see it's a cause for injunctive relief. But paragraph A says we're creating a new cause of action in Minnesota. And this is a committee, by the way, where we've heard a lot of talk about how we live in a sue-happy society and there's too much litigation out there and too many people run to court before doing anything else. But here we're creating a brand new, never-before-seen cause of action. And the plaintiff here can be, among other people, the woman. So the woman has the right to sue. And she can sue for actual and punitive damages and get her attorney's fees. My question is, on what basis, I guess two-part question, on what basis would the woman in this situation who sues a doctor or some other professional performing this procedure, on what basis should that person have a cause of action? And then what are some examples of actual and punitive damages under this brand new cause of action?
Ms. Collette or Representative Holberg?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, Representative. This provision indeed does give both give the woman the opportunity to sue, and it's grounded in a concept, it seems, of informed consent. In this instance, a woman who has undergone the testing, the individualized testing, to determine the post-fertilization age, when the physician goes forward, in contrast to that, there have been numerous cases where women have been subjected to abortions without adequate information and have subsequently claimed that they were ill-informed. In fact, the classic, of course, is Jane Roe, Norma McCorvey, who has sought to reverse Roe versus Wade. There are also instances, such as a case in New York, where a policewoman had given a specimen of urine from her male police partner to the abortion provider. She was told she was pregnant on the basis of that specimen, and the abortion provider sought to initiate an abortion. It was when he took sufficient affirmative steps that she could, in fact, conclude that he was going to go forward, that she arrested him. He was criminally prosecuted. There's also been multiple cases of Medicaid fraud that have been prosecuted because abortionists have failed to provide adequate information. That would be an instance in which a woman could.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Professor Collette, so I didn't understand that at first to be the case. So you're saying one such example, maybe the most prominent example, is where there is misinformation or lack of information given. So just so I understand, this is not a civil remedy for a woman who has the correct information about the correct age and then still chooses to go ahead with the procedure. She would not have the right to then turn around and sue. Am I getting that right? If the information was correct and delivered to her in the correct fashion, she chose to go ahead with the procedure, she could not then turn around and sue under Subdivision 2.
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, the bill does not include an affirmative defense on that basis, Representative. However, it would appear that that would be one of the many defenses that an abortion provider or its insurer would raise.
Ms. Collette and Representative Simon, my understanding would be she probably would if she had emotional distress a year later or other things. Ms. Collette, is that correct? That would arise, and it turns out that she was counseled or allowed to have an abortion post 20 weeks. Am I not understanding it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, you identified the necessity of some injury that would give rise to a cause of action. And, of course, the most common injury from an abortion is a perforated uterus or an infection. There are physical injuries. There has also been some successful claims, although they're limited, on the basis of the failure to give adequate information that resulted in emotional distress. But there would be
But any of those instances would be a harm that would give rise to litigation.
Thank you. Representative Simon, any further? Any other questions, members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Collette. Ms. Collette, I asked a question of Ms. Jackson earlier about whether U.S. Supreme Court decisions provide greater personal protections to the baby than the prevailing decisions here in Minnesota. I'd be interested in your comments in regard to that.
Ms. Blatt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I in fact did bring Doe versus Gomez with me today in, out of a belief that there might be questions about this case. Doe versus Gomez was a case based in the Minnesota Constitution, and contrary to Ms. Jackson's testimony, the court did not adopt a floor-ceiling approach to state constitutional interpretation. On page 30 of the opinion, they simply stated that they are free to interpret the state constitution differently than the federal constitution. In fact, it might be possible for the Minnesota Constitution to have narrower protections than that given of the federal constitution. For instance, if some state action were to arise for a foreign enemy combatant, it may be that the Minnesota Supreme Court for some reason would have such a case and would choose to give smaller protections or lesser protections. It's a matter of the state document that's being interpreted, and the state Supreme Court has chosen in this particular funding case to find that women had a right to funding for therapeutic abortions only, something that the United States Supreme Court had rejected in Harris versus McRae. Ms. Jackson is also incorrect in that the opinion devotes a number of pages to the medical evidence that was presented to the court regarding therapeutic abortions. I would note that House Files 965 before you specifically has a health exception which comports with that of Planned Parenthood versus Casey and is constitutional. Doe versus Gomez speaks of a therapeutic exception, and it is only for therapeutic abortions or those that threaten the life of the mother.
Thank you, Ms. Collette, Mr. Chair.
Representative Glesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to ask this question of Representative Grunhagen in light of his questions to the previous testifier about the development and advancement of science and allowing us to make better decisions. Representative Grunhagen, are you familiar with the names Astenza and Gangini?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me about what their study was?
Not today.
Okay.
I've read their names in articles.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, Astenza and Gangini were two Italian scientists in 1859 who, in their studies on reproductive biology, discovered what they decided in their microscope, which was relatively new technology at the time, a little man in a sperm cell that they called a homunculus. And it was determined by them that this actually was a real person that didn't change at all through the course of human embryonic development, but just got bigger the entire time, thereby giving rise to the political feelings at the time that actually it was a real person at the beginning. There was no fundamental change. Church at that time, which was waning in its influence and the Italian state was rising, sought to provide additional fuel to its growing power and decided that they would enact certain laws based on this science, which ended up, of course, what we, after the fact, determined to be junk science. It wasn't real. It wasn't true. But it didn't stop many people with political agendas from trying to use that junk science in order to advance their own political opinions. Now, I don't know what these studies are about fetal pain, how accurate they are, but I do have a problem with the facts or the truth being entered on the record as part of law, because I think it's always problematic when we allow religion into deciding what the true facts are for the purposes of making law. I hope that's not the case now. I do know that we've run into that problem multiple times in the past, and the incidents of the two Italian scientists in the mid-19th century is by no means the only example of that. And in that case, I hope that this issue is further vetted in ensuring that if we're going to enter any facts on the record, Representative Grunhagen, Mr. Chair, that they're actually accurate based on real science and not just driven by a a religious agenda.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
You've made my point, Representative Lesch. The fact is the Gomez decision was based back in 1995. There's been a tremendous advances in medical science, especially in terms of the unborn and neonatal surgery and the understanding of when life begins since that time. And so I agree with you that over a period of time, things change. The fact is we know more today than we did in 1995 or in 1859.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I don't want to belabor this point, but whether it's a person, Representative Grunhagen, is the question. The Constitution does not afford constitutional rights to life. There are all kinds of life. The question is, does it afford constitutional protections to a person? And if the effort of this science presented in this bill is aimed at deciding that that's a person now, we're getting into religion. That's a religious question that science cannot determine. If it's your faith, more power to you, and that's fantastic. But we cannot legislate faith for everyone else who we represent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Grunhagen.
I did not make my comments based on faith or religion. I based it on medical facts and science, and from a constitutional standpoint, both the preamble of the Constitution and I'll reference the Declaration of Independence, what we're doing here is we're taking a certain group of not just life, but human beings and defining and taking away their right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we're defining them in such a way that we can kill them and destroy them without consequence. Look historically, Representative Lesch, and see which types of governments you're associated with who did the same thing to certain groups of people, whether it's slavery, Jews, and I could name a long list besides that. When a society takes the legal position of removing rights away from certain human beings, it opens the door to the exploitation of those human beings. And that's my point. Not faith, not religion, historical fact, scientific and medical facts. That's my position. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Collette?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
I don't believe that this is a religious issue, Representative Lesch. If you look in the state of Minnesota, we have lots of laws on the books that provide punishment for people that inflict pain on others. And in fact, on a federal level, it seems kind of odd, but we make sure that those that are sentenced to death are comfortable. So from my perspective around this issue, with the growing scientific evidence, and in fact, we had testimony in the health committee from a Catholic priest who was born at either 20 or 21 weeks and survived, example of viability at this stage, but that's not what we're discussing here. But with the growing medical evidence that we are in fact subjecting these unborn children, and I apologize if you don't like that term, to the process of ripping them limb for limb, and if they can feel pain as growing scientific evidence would support, I believe that there has to be a balance. And the state does have an interest in putting together standards and supporting them, and we have for decades, that there should be consequences if one individual inflicts pain on another. We just passed a bill in this legislature for a felony level offense for harm to a dog. Certainly if we can do that, we can pass legislation in the state of Minnesota to protect unborn children from such a painful death.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Collette, I think you made a profound misstatement of law when you were indicating that a state constitution can limit an individual's rights more than the federal constitution, and that the federal constitution does not form a floor beneath which no one can venture. The 14th Amendment is very clear on this point. It's a matter of well-settled law that state constitutions cannot impair rights further than the federal constitution. I think that you just made a very big misstatement of law that should be corrected, if I heard it wrong.
Ms. Collette?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in fact, there are three approaches through the states. My statement was that the state constitution need not be a mirror image nor accept a floor of federal constitutional rights. If the plaintiffs sue on the basis of their federal constitutional rights, even in state courts, it's quite clear that the federal constitutional rights must be protected. But there are numerous cases throughout the country where state courts have refused to create state constitutional rights that do not mirror image that of the federal constitution. One clear example was the Miranda right when it was adopted. We see many instances where state constitutions have been deemed to provide greater protection to public policy and the public's interests than individuals as a matter of state constitutional law. This does not override the supremacy clause of the federal constitution, but in fact my statement is correct.
Mr. Chair, what
the, Representative Hortman.
The witness was disagreeing with the law as stated by the previous witness, and she has just said exactly what the previous witness said, which is that the federal constitution has primacy, and the state can offer greater protection, but it cannot offer lesser protection to an individual or impair the rights of an individual.
Representative Hortman and Ms. Collette, maybe you can add clarity to this. But what I heard you say about a floor ceiling dealt with the Doe v. Gomez wasn't a floor-ceiling discussion as was discussed to our committee prior, but do you have further comment? I'm not sure I heard the same thing you heard, Representative Hartman.
I am happy to provide supplemental written testimony on this, but the law is quite clear that a state constitution where a federal constitutional claim has not been raised can be interpreted to provide lesser protections of rights that have been found in the federal constitution, and I am happy to provide multiple citations to this committee in writing as supplemental testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'd love to see it because it sounds kind of far-fetched.
So, Ms. Collette, if you want to
with your permission,
to Representative
I'll submit
Hortman.
It within 48 hours.
Okay. Get that to Representative Hortman directly, if you will, and also to our committee administrator, please.
Mr. Chairman, happy to do so.
Further questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is more of a process question because it appears as if the questioning is kind of winding down. Mr. Chair, you said that we would have until after session to go through these studies and talk about if we wanted or potentially ask about the findings and facts. So what is your intention for when we come back after session, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom, similar to how I laid it out ahead of time, if we have questions, you've got time right now to ask the witnesses. After session, I would entertain discussion among the committee members and the author and expect to move to a vote. Shortly or long thereafter, depending upon how much committee discussion we have.
Mr. Chair, so you had said that we would have the opportunity to look at these studies. So if we have questions about the specific findings of fact based on the evidence that has been submitted, will the author then be prepared to answer all of those questions and we will not be taking any public testimony at all about our questions on the findings of fact? Or is it your intention to have people come back? My question really, Mr. Chair, is should the people who want to testify about the findings of fact, if we have questions after reviewing this material, should they come back? Or if you're not going to take any testimony anymore on the questions, and Representative Holberg is solely going to be prepared to answer my questions on the studies, I just would like to know that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, I don't know if some of the witnesses will be around after session or not. Ms. Representative Holberg, maybe you have a better idea. Are you particularly talking about Ms. Rao, who made reference to this allegedly, or who are you talking about, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure whoever wrote the findings of fact, but if the legislature is making findings of fact, and now we have evidence and studies that were used to produce the findings of fact, I want to know if I spend the next few hours reading these studies and comparing them to the findings of fact, and I have questions, I want to know if there's going to be someone here to answer them, because, you know, I may disagree with some of the findings of fact, or I may disagree with some of the studies, and I just want to make sure I understand the process, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, do you have any insight on your testifiers if there's questions?
As we discussed earlier, it was my understanding that we were going to do all of the testimony during the regular committee time. I haven't had an opportunity to consult with my witnesses whether or not they'll be available after session. It's my understanding session's supposed to be fairly short, but the majority of the information around the findings in the medical journals, of course, are medical in nature, and so the testifiers that I brought today are more in the realm of the legal issues, and certainly I am not a doctor.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another process question. What time are you intending to reconvene? Is it a set time, minutes after we adjourn session, or is it a set time?
15 minutes after session, Representative Portman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Hillstrom, I would suggest you should ask questions now the best you can. If there's a burning, raging question that the author can't answer and there's somebody in the crowd that can answer it when we're in committee, we can call them up there for limited insight or questions, but I'm not planning to add more testifiers. It would only be in response to some particular narrow question that you have. Also, I think a lot of that would be related to health, potentially the health committee more than the civil law committee. And Representative Hillstrom, as I understand these, and the author can correct this or clarify this further, these are legislative findings that we as a legislature are putting into the legislation. Findings of facts are more what a court would do as they look at the plaintiff and defendant side of a case. And so I think there's a difference between legislative findings and findings of facts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the legislature is making the following findings based on the studies that have been submitted, my question was who paid for all of the studies and which of the studies that are provided in these 14 pages have been peer-reviewed and who were they peer-reviewed by? That would be my question, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Holberg or Ms. Rao or Ms. Collette, do any of you have an answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, I can't give you all that information at this point. We will do our best before the session reconvenes after session, but I can't make any promises for all of that information in an hour and a half.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then which study resulted in each finding of fact? So is the finding of fact that's on line 4.25, is that from the first study, so they're in chronological order, or which finding of fact goes with which study?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, many of these findings are a result of the evolution of science over a number of years, so that would be a little difficult to tie every single one back to a particular finding, but we'll do what we can.
And Representative Hillstrom, I'll just remind you, we will entertain a motion to take stuff out if you find that more palatable as a way to process this bill.
Mr. Chair, if these are actual facts, you may not see me make a motion to remove something, but I can't say that I have found something to be a fact if I don't have any background material and there's been no legislative process to actually figure out which is fact and which is not consensus. For example, Mr. Chair, on the state's website put together by former Governor Pawlenty, it specifically stated that there was no consensus around pain. So my question is, which one of these studies tell me what it is and where it is and where I find it? And because, again, if I'm putting it in fact in the findings, I just want to make sure that there's a real study paid for by a real organization that's been peer-reviewed that actually makes these findings, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Scott?
Yes, I just had a question, Mr. Chair, for the author of the bill.
Go ahead.
Representative Holberg, did you hear medical testimony in the Health and Human Services Committee with this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, there was some medical testimony in the Health Committee.
Okay. I just think that we're barking down the wrong tree here, that all this medical stuff was probably taken care of in the Health and Human Services Committee, and we need to be looking at the legal aspects of it. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, when we put findings into a law, the sad fact is that some poor legal first-year lawyer spends hours and hours and hours trying to figure out what they mean and variety of other things, and somebody gets paid for that, so I guess it does have some validity, although I've required them past when I was chairing committees, I required them to come out of every bill that ever came into the committee that I was chairing for the simple fact that I didn't think they were appropriate. But that's not my question. My question is for Mrs. Rao. Ms. Rao, and the question I have is if we're going to, I mean, I did a quick count, and I'm well past 50 studies in here. I can't read that in 2 hours. There's absolutely no way I can. So if you could tell me where these are these listed online somewhere as this all 12, 15 pages? Are they listed completely so that I can send this out to a couple of people to take a look at and tell me that they're good, bad, or indifferent?
Ms. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, let me just, I have a website that I would direct you to.
Is that doctors?
On fetalpain.org.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure I had it exactly right so I don't give you the wrong thing, but I believe it's on there.
It's printed right on the sheet.
Right, and Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
So is this a report on that website so I can say go to this particular website, you'll look for fetal pain, the evidence, and they'll find it so they can start looking down these websites?
Ms. Rowe.
Or reports, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I believe that this is on there, though I can't guarantee it, although I know the information that is contained on this document did come from there, largely. And I will point out that I think this lays out fairly well. It provides a number of points here, and then includes studies after it that support the claim that we believe to be true. Certainly to those, and so there was a question about how is this laid out, and how can I verify that? There are for each of these points, there are a number of different studies that have been done. They are legitimate medical studies done by a variety of folks, many of them, nearly all of them in the medical profession, including fetal surgeons and those that one would expect to have expertise on these particular issues. If the committee would like, I could provide just a very brief summary of what some of this medical information is. If the chair would like that.
Ms. Rowe, what form would the summary be in?
Just oral.
You want to give an oral summary now?
Very briefly.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, before she starts that.
Representative Mahoney, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, again, 50 plus cited studies in here. In 2 hours, I don't think you can expect even the best of speed readers to read them, much less find them. There are people that I have contact with that have been deeply involved in the reproductive rights issues and would have a better opportunity of giving me, or anyone who would like that, but particularly I'm a little selfish here, an idea of what these studies are, who wrote them, to answer Representative Hillstrom's question. Now, if it's difficult for us to find them, if they have to go searching on a website for them, or I have to go find a fax machine and fax this to someone, it takes longer than 2 hours. Mr. Chair, if you want to just call the question, I think there's 8 votes for this, and you could probably get it through, and we could be done with all the charade here. But, that's what we can do if we want to do it, or you want to actually find out the information and have the discussion. It's up to you.
Representative Mahoney, we don't have the bill. We're reviewing it and covering the bill, and we gave that notice at the beginning. We will have the bill after it's re-referred in committee in session today, and that's what we will be voting on when we come back. Representative Mahoney, this was posted on, it's been introduced for a while. It was in HHS last week. It was posted on our agenda last week. You know, every one of us has a different level of background and research and information gathering we get to choose to do on certain bills. If you need more to convince yourself that there's pain in a fetus at 21 or 22 weeks, you're welcome to do that. I am fairly well convinced. I don't know how other members are. We will find out once the vote is taken, but you have that prerogative. You can talk to the witnesses when we recess. You can you could have met with them prior to this. You can meet with them after this. This is just one more step in the process of this bill. It is not final passage, and you will have many more days to work on getting yourself to that comfortable level if you're not there already.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'm not speaking to pain level or no pain level. What I was speaking to was you're putting into law studies, language developed upon what someone is saying are valid studies. We rarely ever put findings into law. And when we do, they have serious consequences and meaning. And you're asking me to vote on something that, although I'm not, because I am not on the Health Committee, I didn't pay any attention to this. And if you put it up on Friday, on Friday, and you're expecting me to look at the committee assignments over on Saturday and Sunday, I am a part-time legislator. I do not do 24 hours, 7 days a week watching for what's posted and what is in the evidence coming forward. All I'm asking, Mr. Chair, is for information about whether these studies are valid or not. Not whether there is or isn't pain. Not whether there is or isn't enough time to look at something on Friday for a Monday. I'm saying, I'm trying to find out how much time I can have to send this to someone that actually can pronounce some of the language in these medical documents, much less read them.
Ms. Rao, to the question of the study being valid or not, can you review that again for the committee? You also had stated you have a summary of some other medical information. Maybe that would be helpful for the committee. But before we get to that, Representative Druskowski has a comment, and then Ms. Rao, if you could answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, as I look at this, this is really almost a complete bibliography supporting the finding section of this bill, and I'm impressed by the depth of it, how well it's organized. Each of them has a journal citation that each particular study is printed in, Representative Mahoney. So if you want to look up number 3 on page 2, you go to Journal of Experimental Neuropathology and Experimental Neurology, and it took me 2 breaths, Representative Mahoney. But
kind of what I said. I want somebody who can actually pronounce the language.
All you have to do, Representative Mahoney, is type in their website or a quick Google search will get you to the website, and you can do a citation search and come to certainly an abstract that is much longer than these, if not maybe the entire journal article itself.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Druskowski, thank you for that. I agree. I mean, I think that the information that the committee now has that we had provided to the Health Committee previously as well is fairly complete and really does support each of the legislative findings that we have. As a brief summary to that, I would like to state that there are 5 points related to fetal pain and the ability of the unborn child to feel pain that are really not disputed by anyone that I have heard of. Those are, first of all, that pain receptors are present throughout the unborn child's body by no later than 16 weeks after fertilization. And those nerves link, these receptors to the brain's thalamus and subcortical plate by no later than 20 weeks. Second, by 8 weeks after fertilization, the unborn child reacts to touch. By 20 weeks after fertilization, the unborn child reacts to stimuli that would be recognized as painful if applied to an adult human, for example, by recoiling. Third, application of such painful stimuli is associated with significant increases in stress hormones, known as the stress response, which I mentioned in my testimony earlier as well. Fourth, subjection to such painful stimuli is associated with long-term harmful neurodevelopmental effects, such as altered pain sensitivity and possibly emotional, behavioral, and learning disabilities later in life. And finally, fifth, for the purposes of fetal surgery, fetal anesthesia is routinely administered and is associated with a decrease in stress hormones compared to their level when painful stimuli is applied without such anesthesia. The subduing or elimination of this stress response is crucial due to its impact of the unborn child's survival rates and long-term effects on development. Now, I mentioned that there were 5 facts that were not in dispute, and those are them. Now, there is one issue where some folks have said, no, the unborn child cannot feel pain because of this, and I will share that with the committee as well. The question that is in dispute is whether or not the cortex is ready to essentially receive those painful, or receive the nerve, and whether or not that is ready and developed enough to be used. Now, some folks claim that because the cortex connection is not yet there, that unborn child cannot feel pain, even separate from all of the facts that I just talked about that seem to show evidence of that pain. However, there have actually been studies that have been done, not related in any way to abortion or fetal pain specifically, but about the cortex and whether or not it is needed to feel pain and other emotions. And this was done on older children who actually, as this study, they were taken to Disney World or Disneyland, I forget which one, and the researcher actually watched them because there was a belief that these children could not, because of the lack of the cortex being connected, feel pain in those kinds of things. And he was able to see children falling down and reacting to painful stimuli. Additionally, he was able to see happiness and joy and those kinds of things, which also were thought not to be able to happen without a functioning cortex. I will point out as well that two of these such studies that it at least imply that the unborn child does not feel pain until later in pregnancy. One of them was published in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association. And that study should be pointed out, because you seem to have an interest as well about who was doing the studies and whether or not they were legitimate, if you will, that study, the lead author of it, was actually a former lawyer for NARAL, the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, and a first-year medical student at the time. Also, another author on that study was Dr. Eleanor Dre, and she is, at the time at least, I'm not sure if she still is, but I know at the time the study was released, she was the director of the largest abortion clinic in San Francisco, and according to Dr. Dre, the facility that she ran performs about 600 abortions a year between the 20th and 23rd weeks of pregnancy. Additionally, there was another study, one of the other few studies, that refuted the fact that unborn child feel pain was by the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and included in that study was an abortionist as well. So it seems that the studies that indicate or imply or state that the unborn child are not capable of feeling pain are coming from the abortion industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Representative Pepin, and then we're going to need a recess.
Thank you. I just have a request. I'm wondering, since Ms. Rao and others have presented some 30 pages of studies that support their beliefs, I'm wondering if perhaps for this afternoon we could ask the folks who oppose this on the other side, I see if the ACLU or Ms. Perpich could present the findings which would contradict it. Ms. Rao stated that there were at least 5 points that were virtually undisputed amongst the medical community, and it seems that a lot of folks are somewhat skeptical on that, and I thought perhaps that the other side could, if those things were not true, if they could provide the evidence and also perhaps dispute the last contention point that Ms. Rao made about them being abortionists, if that is not true as well. So that would be my first request, if that would be possible by anyone. That would be helpful information, I think, so that we'd have more balanced information. The second request I would have is, and this is unfortunately for staff, maybe Mr. Gehring, since we've had a lot of talks about legislative findings and what, you know, when we use them and whether or not we've done them and have we, you know, how are they used, I'm wondering, I hate to ask you to spend lots of time, but I'm wondering if we can get a little tutorial on legislative findings and how and when they've been used in the past, because it seems to me that I've been forced to vote on such legislative findings on things that I did not agree on at all, but still passed in the legislature. And it seems to me it's also been not just in committee, but on the floor of the House in the form of amendments. And I'm just wondering if, I know it would be hard to get all of those, but if we could get some examples of examples in our statute books where there are legislative findings or any history, that would be helpful to make a more informed decision.
To this point, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, Representative Pepin, you know, you can't prove a negative. It's the burden of the proponents of the bill to come forward and meet the test of whether they can convince people that it's true. And to bring up evidence to say, okay, well, you know, it's not true, I mean, I think that's stretching a little bit. Obviously, there are disputes about that. However, remember, it's up to the proponents to come forward to put forth the information to meet the burden before there's any suggestion of saying, okay, we'll prove not. You just can't do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Representative Lesch, I have approximately 30 pages of studies and testimony from Ms. Rao saying that it's virtually an undisputed fact amongst medical professionals, and she said at least 5 points. And to me, the information is here. And since several members said or felt apparently that this wasn't, you know, they weren't sure if this was valid information or not, I thought it would be helpful to save time to have any information available that would dispute what Ms. Rao testified to. And I don't, you know, I understand what you're saying, but it would be very helpful to, if what she said is wrong, I would like to see that, and I too would like to be able to have the opportunity to understand if the information that she said is not accurate.
Mr. Chair, if I could briefly.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. This might be able to clear it up, because I see your point, Representative Pepin, but I'd like to know, and I don't see any other law professors in the room, but maybe Ms. Collette might be able to answer this question and might be able to clear it up. Can we pass something in a bill that our facts in this committee, is it legal to pass something as a finding of fact in a bill that we know not to be true? For example, could we pass findings of fact in a bill in this committee and get it passed by law that says this building is located in Colorado? Could we legally do that?
Ms. Collette, I don't know if you have an answer to that. Mr. Gehring might otherwise, but might not either. Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, do you have the authority to pass a statement of fact that you are intention that you know is false, or is it a mistake?
No, that you know is false, Mr. Chair. Ms. Collette.
I'm unaware of any case addressing that. There were cases, in fact, the second Carhartt case addressed mistakes, in fact, and certainly the Congress had the authority to do so, but if it could be proven mistaken in the court, then the court would disregard it.
Okay, but Mr. Chair, Ms. Collette, could we, I think I understand you saying that technically, legally, we could do that. Is that true? If we wanted to, we could pass it.
Again, I'm unaware of any case or statute that specifically says that any legislative body can pass as a finding of fact a known false statement.
Okay. Well, I think that clears it up then, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Jackson, if you'd come up here, I have 10 seconds of question for you, and then we're going to recess. Ms. Jackson, you heard Representative Pepin's question. Do you have some studies that you could provide to the committee? I'm not looking, Representative Pepin, to have Ms. Jackson come back and add more testimony afterwards, but if there's specific studies they have, we would welcome them between now and later. And if there's, again, as I told Representative Hortman or Hillstrom, if there's a raging question that the author can't answer, we'll be limited strictly to that type of feedback to the committee.
Well,
Ms. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman, our organization is a legal organization, not a medical organization, so I'm going to defer to Ms. Perpich, if that's all right with you.
Ms. Perpich. Do you have an answer, Ms. Perpich?
Mr. Chairman.
You can identify yourself for, for our
record. Connie Perpich with Planned Parenthood of Minnesota, North and South Dakota. I don't have an answer, precisely. We can. We did have testimony in the health committee from an OBGYN from the University of Minnesota who said she had done recently an extensive medical search and found it non-conclusive, which would mirror what is currently on the Minnesota Department of Health's website under informed consent. I would say Planned Parenthood, too, would like to know what is the best medical answer, obviously, on this question, and it keeps coming back. There is no conclusive evidence. And so if you wanted us to try to do a medical search, we can. We are, that's not our expertise, Representative.
Ms. Perpich, I'm not, some members of the committee may ask you to do that. They can do that individually. If you had it readily available, the committee would welcome it, but we're not asking you to go out and do more.
If I may say, perhaps a better organization to help you here would be the Minnesota Medical Association or the Minnesota Society of Obstetricians, Gynecologists, and I, too, believe they will come up. You'd have to ask them directly. I believe they will come up and say we do not have conclusive scientific evidence.
Well, Representative Pepin, to this point.
Well, Mr. Representative Westrum and Ms. Perpich, I think, you know, I guess the point I was getting at is I haven't seen any, we have a lot of documented studies, and there are some folks in the committee that had issue or taken issue with some of these studies or perhaps suggested that maybe they're not accurate or they wanted to look and see if they're accurate. And I just felt that for a more balanced approach, if they were not accurate, I would like to also see those studies that disputed the evidence they provided. So right now I feel like I have evidence, a lot of evidence on one side that shows that there is indeed pain, but I don't have much of anything on the other side, so it leads me to only one conclusion. And I wanted to give the opposition an opportunity to provide those studies and facts that shows that this is what the other side has presented is not true. That's it's up to you whether you would like to present anything or not.
Duly noted, Representative Pepin and Representative Holberg, you have a
Thank
final
you,
comment.
Mr. Chair and committee, and I know we have to get to caucus and we have to research, but if the people that want more medical information think I'm going to be able to speak like a doctor after session, I won't be able to. We as legislators are charged with gathering the best information that we can find, using our life experience, and making good decisions. And as I reviewed this information in preparing for the committee, I went online and looked at what a thalamus was and a cortex and brushed up on the development of the neurological system. But boiling it down and reviewing all of this, I guess the piece of information, at least for myself personally, that was most compelling was that in this new emerging field of surgery, that initially they used paralytics. In other words, they paralyzed the baby when they were doing surgery. But they recognized the increase of the stress hormone during those procedures. And now, as a standard of course, they administer both a paralytic and pain medication in the case of these surgeries on babies at this stage of development. I'm no doctor. I can understand the concept of that, the evolution, the learning, the changing, the presence of hormones that mirror that those hormones that are emitted in adults in situations of pain. And so, I mean, we can, I will lose if we're going to have a battle of the medical doctors, because I'm not a medical doctor. But I have read a lot of information about this issue, and I am convinced from a variety of sources, some of them, in fact, being abortionists, that these are little human beings, and at 20 weeks of pain, when we are ripping them limb for limb, they feel pain. And that we, as state legislators in the state of Minnesota, not only have the right, but we have the duty to do something about it.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Members, we will recess till after session, 15 minutes after session, approximately 4:15. I understand. Basement hearing room. Basement hearing room, approximately 15 minutes after session.
I assume that would be the best one.
Basement hearing room is where we'll be reconvening approximately 15 minutes after session. Meeting is in recess. We'll call the Civil Law Committee back to order from recess. Representative Holberg, we'll just enter into committee discussion. Members, any further questions or discussion? Representative Lesh, any new information since we last recessed?
No, Mr. Chair, no information, and I know I can't necessarily speak for all members on my side, but I myself am fully informed and ready to vote.
Okay. Questions, members? Any further questions? Is there anybody in the audience that, well, no, we've already opened up for testimony. So, members, just Joyce, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if anyone came forward with any of the additional information that I requested earlier to see if there were any disputes or any studies that refute any of the facts that we have in our packet.
Representative Pepin, I am not aware of any. Representative Lesh or Representative Hillstrom, are you aware of any more information that's became available to you or anybody on the committee that would be helpful in making your decision, your opinion, decision, or Representative Pepin's?
Mr. Chair, I have no additional information.
You don't?
I'm ready to vote.
Okay. Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. If I might, there was quite a lot of discussion around the findings of fact and issues related to the court, and I just, I stated before the break my inability to speak in medical jargon, not being a doctor, but in looking at some of the material in previous court cases, specifically in the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy reaffirmed the standard in Gonzales, in the court giving the state and federal legislatures wide discretion to pass legislation in areas where there is medical and scientific uncertainty. And relating to the abortion context in particular, he writes, medical uncertainty does not foreclose the exercise of legislative power in the abortion context any more than it does in any other context. And in closing, as we well know and have learned over the years, the courts are a separate branch of government and, in fact, make their own findings relative to cases that come before them. And then just relative to the Nebraska issue, there was a question about, making the point that the Nebraska law hadn't been challenged, but this wasn't Nebraska, that Minnesota, of course, had its own standards, and we recognize that. But I think the point does have to be made that Carhart is not afraid of lawsuits. In fact, he's taken a number of them in this area all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the case of the Nebraska law, which now is over a year old, Carhart has not, as of yet, chosen to fight that law or challenge that law in the Nebraska courts, but rather he's packed up and moved to other states. And I think that can inform this decision as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holbrook. I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know you've taken a lot of arrows today, and I'm really glad that someone is bringing this legislation forward that protects the unborn child from really inhumane treatment. I mean, in fact, it's beyond inhumane. As we stated before, we don't even treat animals this way. So I just want to thank you for bringing it forth, and hopefully this will pass through to the House. Thank you, or the floor.
With that, Representative Scott, we need to have a motion in front of us, and so the chair will move House File 936 be recommended to pass and passed and sent to the General Register. That'll be the motion, members. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesh.
My understanding was there are criminal penalties in this bill. I was expecting that this would be sent to Judiciary Public Safety especially. What happened to that, Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesh, we've talked with the committees, and I understand they don't need to see it, as the last I was told. If something would change, we would have to re-refer it from the floor. Representative Holbrook, do you have any further insight on that?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I sent an email out to all chairs that I thought might want to take a look at this bill. Over a week ago, I've had direct conversations with Chair Cornish and Chair Pepin, and at this point, neither of them want to see this bill in their committee. We are moving the bill to the floor, recognizing that we don't have a completed fiscal note yet and that the State Government Finance Committee schedule is quite heavy this week in getting their omnibus bill together. Once we see the details of the fiscal note, there's a pretty good chance this bill will then be referred to State Government Finance relative to the Attorney General issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how we can't have a fiscal note when it states right in the bill that it's creating a fund for defense. So I would think that it should go to some fiscal committee, and creating a new crime certainly makes it appropriate to go to public safety.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I don't know if I wasn't clear. We're sending it to the floor at this point and waiting for a fiscal note. We don't know what fiscal components will show up in the fiscal note. Certainly if there's a fiscal component relative to Representative Cornish or Smith's committee, we'll address that as well. But I think the most likely one is one around the Attorney General's office.
If at all, right? I mean, we don't know there's one yet either way.
We don't know, and of course the highest priority right now for fiscal notes is being given to those issues being contained in omnibus bills, and so I fully expect that it's going to go somewhere else. We're just not sure where at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It has not been the practice of this House to send bills that we think that are going to be fiscally, have a fiscal impact to the floor, and we typically don't send criminal bills to the floor without going through one of the multiple crime committees. I'm going to ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Roll call been requested. Any further discussion, members? Having none, the clerk. Clerk will take the roll.
Representative Westrom?
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski?
Yes.
Representative Lesch?
No.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Holberg?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe? Representative Hortman?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mazzarol?
Yes.
Representative Pepin?
Yep.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Runbeck?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
The motion does pass with 9 yes, 7 opposed. Motion's approved. Any other issues in front of the committee members? With none, the meeting is adjourned. Just committee note, we will not have a committee on Wednesday, and next week there's nothing planned either at this point. If something changes, we will alert you, but tentatively nothing Wednesday or next week with omnibus bills.
You got my phone?